I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Easing the cost of living crisis grows most difficult by the day, with the war in Ukraine accelerating the rising prices of energy and food. Add the impacts of conflicts, droughts, hunger and extreme poverty, and the result is a perfect storm for perpetuating poverty and injustice.
As the UN Secretary General blasts wealthy nations for rigging the global economy for their benefit, we'll speak to the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz about how war, the pandemic, and the climate emergency are causing economic crises across the globe. And as we move in on the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we'll speak with MSNBC host Mehdi Hasan about his new book, Win Every Argument, and his views on Fox News.
It's very hard when 20-30% of the American public has been cocooned off in a bubble where they are fed misinformation, disinformation by the likes of Ingram and Hannity and Rupert Murdoch, who goes under oath in a deposition and says, yeah, my host endorsed the big lie. Yeah, you know, I don't believe in it. But by the way, according to the reporting, Murdoch hands over secret Democratic Party ads and that haven't aired yet to Jared Kushner. He gives debate strategy to Kushner. In any other news organization, heads would roll. But Fox is not a news organization.
This as the Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy hands over 40,000 hours of January 6 video to Fox. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's considering a plan to start detaining asylum-seeking families who are apprehended in the U.S.-Mexico border area after U.S. officials had largely ended the practice over the past 2 years. The move comes as the U.S. continues to intensify its crackdown on asylum seekers as it prepares to phase out the contested Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy in May. The rule's been used to expel over 2 million migrants without due process at the southern border. Silky Shaw of the Detention Watch Network said on Twitter, Biden confirming his Obama 2.0 status with this news. I really hope it's a trial balloon that doesn't go anywhere. But if not, they're definitely going to get a fight, she said. Last month, the Biden administration proposed another policy that would force tens of thousands of asylum seekers to first seek protection in Mexico or another country they passed through on their trek to the U.S. Harsher immigration policies are forcing asylum seekers to rely on more dangerous methods and routes to reach the U.S. In Mexico, over 340 migrants from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador and Ecuador were found in an abandoned truck in the state of Veracruz Sunday. More than 100 unaccompanied migrant children were among the group. In Tunisia, authorities have arrested hundreds of sub-Saharan African refugees following President Kais Saied's racist remarks last month calling for an end to sub-Saharan migration as he claimed black migrants were part of a so-called plot to alter Tunisia's demographics. The comments have triggered a wave of violence and hate crimes against African refugees, forcing many of them to seek safety at the UN's International Organization for Migration building in the capital, Tunis, after being attacked. The president has faced widespread backlash over his remarks. The African Union postponed a conference scheduled to take place in Tunisia this month. Meanwhile, the Biden administration said it was concerned by the comments as well as the arbitrary arrest of refugees in Tunisia. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price addressed the issue Monday.
These remarks are not in keeping with Tunisia's long history of generosity in hosting and protecting refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants, and we're disturbed by reports of violence against these very migrants. We urge Tunisian authorities to meet their obligations under international law to protect the rights of refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants.
South Korea has agreed to set up a fund to compensate victims of forced labor during Japan's colonization of Korea in the first half of the 20th century. South Korea's foreign ministry plans to raise the funds through voluntary contributions by businesses. South Korean survivors condemned the agreement as a betrayal by their own government. They've been pushing for the funds to come directly from Japanese companies responsible for enslaving Koreans, including Nippon Steel Corporation and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. Supporters of the victims rallied against the agreement at a protest in Seoul Tuesday.
We condemn the South Korean government for exempting Japan from its responsibility. It should have stood up to the Japanese government and engaged in diplomatic negotiations.
Japan should apologize and compensate. But it doesn't make sense that the government proposed compensation in this shameful way without Japan's apology.
In Washington, President Biden celebrated the deal Monday as a groundbreaking new chapter of cooperation and partnership between Japan and South Korea. North Korea's government's warned the United States against shooting down any of its missiles. Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, said any such interception would be viewed as a declaration of war. Her warning came a day after the U.S. flew a nuclear-capable B-52 bomber over the Korean Peninsula in a joint drill with South Korean warplanes. Meanwhile, Japan's space agency failed in its debut attempt to launch its new H-3 rocket to orbit on Tuesday after the vehicle's second stage engine failed to ignite. The malfunction destroyed a land observation satellite that was designed to help detect North Korean ballistic missile launches. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is planning to meet Taiwan's president in the coming weeks when she visits California. The Financial Times reports Tsai Ing-wen convinced McCarthy to meet her on U.S. soil rather than in Taipei to avoid an aggressive Chinese military response. In Beijing, China's new foreign minister, Qin Gang, condemned the U.S. stance over Taiwan Tuesday in his first news conference since taking office.
The Chinese people have every right to ask, why does the U.S. talk at length about respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity on Ukraine while disrespecting China's sovereignty and territorial integrity on the Taiwan question? Why does the U.S. ask China not to provide weapons to Russia while it keeps selling arms to Taiwan?
Those remarks came as Chinese President Xi Jinping directly accused the United States of suppressing China's development Monday in what the Wall Street Journal described as a, quote, unusually blunt rebuke of U.S. policy. She said, quote, Western countries led by the U.S. have implemented all-round containment, encirclement and suppression against us, bringing unprecedentedly severe challenges to our country's development, he said. Ukraine's military leaders have called off plans to retreat from the eastern city of Bakhmut, requesting reinforcements amid some of the heaviest fighting since Russia invaded over 1 year ago. Military analysts say that while both sides are suffering heavy casualties, Russian conscripts and Wagner Group mercenaries are dying at a faster rate. This week, the U.S. think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, estimated Russian deaths in Ukraine have surpassed all its war fatalities since World War II combined, with as many as a quarter of a million dead and wounded in the first year of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. A court in Belarus has convicted opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya to charges of treason, sentencing her in absentia to 15 years in prison. In 2020, she ran for president against Belarus's longtime leader, Alexander Lukashenko, after her husband, Sergei, was jailed while running for president. She fled Belarus to exile in neighboring Lithuania after the election. In Haiti, the humanitarian aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is considering suspending its operations after a series of shootouts at its clinics in Port-au-Prince and other violent incidents as the island nation is increasingly controlled by gangs. Locals are also facing deepening food insecurity and hunger, while medicine and other resources are extremely hard to access due to the turmoil. Human rights advocates have documented severe abuses, including sexual violence and hundreds of killings. A new report by the UN says weapons are being smuggled from the United States and ending up in the streets of Haiti. Fighting between gangs has also intensified over the control of territory, forcing families to flee their homes.
I was sleeping on the street. I came back this morning and I see that things are still the same.
Are you going to leave the house permanently?
I have no place to go.
The Biden administration is considering a plan to vaccinate millions of chickens against avian influenza. The plan comes amidst the worst outbreak of the viral disease in U.S. history, which has killed tens of millions of domesticated chickens, turkeys and ducks, along with countless wild birds. It's been blamed for thousands of sea lion deaths in Peru and has sickened and killed dozens of other species, raising fears it could lead to community spread among humans. In Georgia, prosecutors have charged 23 forest defenders with domestic terrorism charges after their arrest late Sunday at a festival near the site of Cop City, a massive police training facility being built in the Wilani Forest. The arrest followed clashes between police and protesters Sunday afternoon. On Monday, Atlanta interfaith clergy members joined activists calling on Mayor Andre Dickens and other city officials to cancel the $90 million Cop City project.
To ignore the cries of residents, the city of Atlanta moves to destroy the nation's largest urban forest and replace it with the largest militarized police training facility in North America. And may I add that in the face of the violent raid that took place last night, as city residents gathered in solidarity to defend this forest, that is an example of the militarization that we are calling out.
In Ohio, Norfolk Southern has agreed to a limited plan to relocate residents of East Palestine affected by the February 3rd rail disaster, which caused a massive release of vinyl chloride and other toxic chemicals. Local activists with the group River Valley Organizing called the move an important first victory, but said in a statement, quote, bottom line, this is not enough. A one-mile radius for relocation doesn't reflect the facts on the ground that this chemical disaster has had a far-reaching impact. We need to stop letting Norfolk Southern put their profits ahead of the people of our community, they said. And in Minneapolis, environmental justice advocates are appealing to Minnesota's state legislature and Supreme Court for relief after city councilors voted 7-6 to demolish a warehouse on a former Superfund site in South Minneapolis. Residents of the East Phillips neighborhood and surrounding communities fear the demolition of the roof depot site, which stir up toxic chemicals from a site known as the Arsenic Triangle, and have proposed turning the building as an indoor urban farm and community business hub. Last month, over 100 Minneapolis police swarmed the site and arrested eight activists who'd occupied the space to prevent its demolition. This is Cassie Holmes, a resident of the nearby Little Earth housing complex, which is home to many Native Americans.
The way I found out about this site was that I had lost my oldest son, who was 16, to a heart condition he wasn't born with. My best friend lost a child at an early age of 20 after her second child to a heart disease she wasn't born with. We lost friends to asthma attacks, and we start learning about how toxic the air is in our community. And then so we wanted to create a green space with green living, green jobs, green training, and it was going to be at this site right here. But the city threatened eminent domain. They got the site, and what they want to do is break down, demolish this building, which is encapsulated arsenic, and everything that they want to bring in is just going to create a lot more toxic pollution for our already over-toxic community.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak to the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz about how war, the pandemic, and the climate emergency are causing economic crises across the globe. Stay with us.
Well, I know there are answers, and I gotta get to the source. I think me and this system got to get a divorce. I can't make enough money and I can't find enough time. But I'm a hard-working woman and the future is mine. Well, there's more where I come from. Yeah, and we got anger to burn. but we're talking and moving. We're gonna study.
Working class woman, Barbara Dane, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, it's been nearly 3 years since much of the world shut down as COVID-19 rapidly spread across the globe. And it's just over a year since Russia invaded Ukraine. These two events, the pandemic and the war, have reshaped the global economy. Some have seen their wealth soar, but billions have suffered. Earlier this week, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the opening of the Summit of Least Developed Countries in Doha, Qatar.
Easing the cost of living crisis grows most difficult by the day, with the war in Ukraine accelerating the rising prices of energy and food. Add the impacts of conflicts, droughts, hunger, and extreme poverty, and the result is a perfect storm for perpetuating poverty and injustice. We must end this storm. But we must recognize that to end this storm, we require massive and sustainable investment. And least developed countries require and deserve massive financial and economic support. For your countries, progress on the Sustainable Development Goals, starting with the eradication of extreme poverty and ending hunger, is about more than lines on a chart leading to 2030. It is a matter of life and death, and it is unacceptable if you are held back by processes and decisions that are made far beyond your borders.
To talk more about the state of the global economy, we're joined by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He's a Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Professor Stiglitz is also currently the chief economist of the Roosevelt Institute. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Joe. It's great to have you with us. These are very, very difficult times. Let's follow up on what the UN Secretary General has talked about, the crisis in the world today. As we look at the international economic crisis, soaring inflation, devaluation, currencies, nations across the globe confronting catastrophic debt crisis. Can you talk about the situation globally?
Well, you've described it. What concerns me right now is that all of this is being made worse by monetary policies, the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, when the problem is not excess aggregate demand. The problem is supply-side interruptions, demand shifts caused by the very forces that you described, the war, the pandemic. And let me be frank, raising interest rates designed to slow the economy down, increase unemployment, is going to be not the right policy for addressing the inflation that we face.
You're talking about Jay Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, who's going to be addressing Congress or speaking to, being questioned by Congress today and tomorrow. You are a fierce critic.
That's right. I think they misdiagnosed the problem. And because of the misdiagnosis, the solution is not only the wrong solution, it's a solution that may make things worse. Raising interest rates from the level of zero where they were to a normal level was a right move. We needed to normalize interest rates. But continuing to raise the interest rates has having the effect of globally leading to exchange rate devaluations. It will worsen the global debt crisis. Countries already over debt will find it even more difficult to pay back. But even coming back to the United States, one of the major sources of inflation is housing. And what are the increasing interest rates? inducing a reduction in investment in housing, making the problem even worse. When we have all these supply side interruptions and demand shifts, we need more investment. And his response is to have less investment.
Well, Joe Stiglitz, for those people who are not versed in economics, why are higher interest rates so detrimental, especially to the global South? I mean, clearly there's going to be a flight of investment capital from other portions of the world into U.S. Treasuries, and there's also and the impact that this has on the debt of the countries of the global South, as well as their own monetary value of their own money.
So when the money leaves these other countries and goes into the United States, into the dollar, it increases the value of the dollar. It decreases the value of their own currency. The problem is that the money that they borrowed overwhelmingly is denominated in dollars. So what they earn abroad, what they earn at home is worth less relative to what they owe to their creditors. And so it makes it harder and harder for them to pay. But making it still worse is not only is the value of their currency lower, the interest rates they have to pay are higher. And making it still worse, the intent of this is to have a global economic slowdown. And so these countries that depend vitally on exports will find that they can sell less. The value of what they are, of their economy goes down. They're paying higher interest rates. The IMF and the World Bank have warned about a debt crisis. And what the Federal Reserve is doing now is making the risk of a much worse global debt crisis. Countries that are poor will get even poorer.
I wanted to ask you about another impact of the war in Ukraine that is not often talked about. For decades now, we've had proponents of neoliberalism claim that free trade is the key to the world economic development. But as you were mentioning, supply chain issues during COVID, as well as the war in Ukraine, have suddenly exposed the flaws of assuming that you've got a world economic system where you can get goods from any part of the world, just-in-time production of most of these companies. What is the future of free trade now, given the rising, not only the pandemic, but the impact of the Ukraine war on the world?
Well, you put your finger on a major problem of the kind of economic system that we've developed in the last 40 years, what you call the neoliberal system. It was short-sighted. We saw that in 2008, the global financial crisis caused by short-sighted banks focusing on exploiting poor Americans, predatory lending, abusive credit card practices, excessive risk-taking. But part of this pattern of short-sightedness was saying, if I can get oil, gas, a few pennies cheaper, I'll do it regardless of the risk. I wrote in my book, Making Globalization Work, in 2006, that Europe's becoming so dependent on Russian gas was foolish. It was short-sighted. Putin was not a reliable source of energy. And unfortunately, that prediction turned out all too true, and leading to the energy crisis that we faced, and Europe particularly faced, in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think we've learned that markets are short-sighted. The just-in-time inventory production system made our economy very unresilient. And so the economic consequences of the pandemic were amplified by this fundamental mistake in the market economy. You know, we always pointed out that markets don't price carbon. That's reason that they go engage in excessive pollution. But they also don't price risk. And we are now rethinking the nature of the global economic system. Ironically, this is going on even on the part of those, say, Republicans who supported free trade. The bipartisan bills on IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS Act, both ignored basic rules of the WTO in trying to give preference to American firms and trying to resuscitate American production. They may be good policies, but they contravene international trading norms. So we are going to have to redefine the global international order.
I also wanted to ask you about the impact of the rising tensions between China and the United States in for the world economy, and especially for the poorest sectors of the of our planet. We've seen the statement by President Xi Jinping recently claiming that the United States is seeking to encircle and contain China. Even more extraordinary was a statement issued by the Chinese foreign ministry just last week. It was an extraordinarily critical overview of how China sees the role of the United States in the world, claiming it's the greatest source of violence and instability in the world, both militarily and economically. And I'm wondering what your sense is of the potential impact that a lot of people who are claiming that we've got to get tougher on China, what the implications are for the economy, given how much China has become the manufacturing center of the planet.
Well, first, let me say my first concern is that there are a number of global problems that we need to work together. We have to address the problem of global warming. We are just getting over the pandemic, and most epidemiologists believe that there is likely to be another pandemic. We don't know when, but certainly when it occurs, we will need high levels of global cooperation. So this heightened rhetoric from both sides has diminished our ability to cooperate in areas where we have to cooperate. Of course, we have to be vocal in our criticism of the diminution of what China did to democracy in Hong Kong, what it's doing with the Uyghurs. I think we have to be frank about that. At the same time, I think we have to be very targeted in our response and broadsides of the kind that both sides have engaged in make it difficult for us to undertake the cooperative actions that we need. At the same time, I think not only do we have to be blunt about the violations of human rights and democracy, we have to call out some of the policies that have had devastating effects on developing countries. China has lent money to many countries without appropriately assessing the returns on that money. Sometimes there are allegations of corruption. But when countries have had problems, there's been a reluctance to restructure debt. Sri Lanka has become the poster child. If the debt crisis that that has been anticipated turns out to be real, there will have to be debt restructurings. But there will have to be debt restructurings that are comprehensive, including China and the private sector from the West. The private sector from the West is often engaged also in reckless lending and occasionally in corrupt practices. So I don't want to put my finger in one direction. This is a global problem. There will have to be debt restructurings, and we have to have ways of making sure that money that is lent to these countries are lent for productive purposes, not for enriching the lender or for geopolitical reasons.
You are the author, Joe Stiglitz, of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict.